Thank you, ladies, and thank you for the privilege this morning of opening the Book of God to the people of God here in this place, for we know these words are a savor of life unto life to all who will receive them. I sometimes wonder if, when you're in the midst of a seminary experience like this, if you can really grasp the dynamic of what God is doing in this place, not now, but what's going to happen as the decades unfold before us, as so many of you go out to that place of service that God has designed for you that no one can do quite like you can do. And that really is the burden of the message I want to share with you this morning, and want to invite you to turn to the first chapter of Jeremiah as you do so. And as you're turning, let me bring you greetings from the Annuity Board. We have right now over 9,000 Southern Baptist pastors and or their widows that are in their retirement years who are living on $200 a month or less in benefits. Perhaps their church has never provided for them. They never made preparation earlier in ministry. And so we have the tremendous challenge of raising funds to help them and supplement them, That's why we have our adopt annuitant program that God is blessing in such a wonderful fashion. But I'll tell you, our passion also is for the next two generations of young people, young adults who are going out into Southern Baptist ministry, that they might be able to get to that year of retirement, not because we're taking all the emphasis off of retirement, putting it on what we want to call retooling, because when many churches cause folks to retire in the future, the next two generations, 65 or 70, many of these next two generations are going to have 15, 20, 25 good, healthy years. We're going to live longer than any generations in human history after our vocational retirement. And our dream is that if we can get these next two generations to that particular point of their ministry where they can retire with some financial dignity and have enough strength to support themselves in retirement, then we're going to be able to unleash upon the world, in conjunction with our two mission boards, the greatest force of volunteers on mission the world has ever seen. Folks who've spent their life in ministry, matching seasoned pastors with church planters in pioneer areas, and not only in America, but all over the world. And that's a part of the driving force. You know, Solomon said in Proverbs 6, "Go to the ant, you sluggard, and be wise, and consider her ways. How that ant stores up food in summer so that when the harvest, the winter comes, they'll have a supply there to take." Now, that's good advice for an ant. That's good advice for somebody who's in the ministry of God. We want to encourage you to get in our program, our retirement program, as quickly as you can, because there's a certain thing called compound interest over the years that really makes an incredible difference. And not only that, when you're in a church, serving in a church, and you're in our annuity board program, you automatically receive free a survivor benefit, $100,000 for your wife. We had a young pastor in Arkansas last year, 28 years old, killed in a car wreck. Just been in our program a few months, and his wife received a $100,000 survivor benefit. They didn't even know that they had, but you automatically get it free by being in our program. A disability program, God forbid, if something should happen to you that helps you with $500 a month, regardless of what other insurance program you have for the rest of your life in ministry. So those two things are a safety net that every church ought to have their pastor in, their church worker in, and we want to encourage you to be a part of that. Don McLeod from our staff is going to be here tomorrow and Thursday over in the Ledford Center. We're going to provide a lunch for the first 50 of you tomorrow who'd like to be a part of that, but Don will be over there for the next 2 days sharing valuable and vital information for you, and I hope you'll be a part of that. Now, as we turn our attention to our text for this morning, you know, one of the things in ministry, pastoring for a quarter of a century, that I learned was that it's a very easy thing, if you're not careful, to find your way into some sort of a comfort zone. Comfort zones are some of the most dangerous deterrents to effective ministry that one can find. There are all kinds of comfort zones. You know, seminary can be a comfort zone for some folks. There are sociological comfort zones. There are economic comfort zones where we just have fellowship and only interact with those in our own socioeconomic level. There are political comfort zones where we find ourselves only in a comfort zone politically, never wander out of it. There are even theological comfort zones. There are all sorts of comfort zones that come in life. And one of the greatest motivating factors to move us out of those comfort zones that are detrimental to life and ministry is the idea of purpose or design. That is, that something, or rather someone, is behind it all, forming you and fashioning you to do something that no one else can do quite like you can. That's why no one else has a thumbprint like yours, a fingerprint like yours. No one else has a DNA exactly like yours, because you're an individual, indescribably valuable to God, who has a job for you to do that no one can do quite like you can do. The tragedy is that so many people go through life without any real conscious awareness. I'm talking about even in ministry, that behind it all is such purpose and such design, and a Creator God who's continuing to form us and fashion us according to His will in the particular place where He wants us to be. So the intent of our message this morning is for all of us to leave here in a few minutes with a fresh awareness of how indescribably valuable we are to God, and a fresh awareness of what brought us to this place and why we're here to begin with. You know, singing these great hymns of the faith remind me of the first hymn I ever sung. I memorized that day when I was saved, when I was 17. Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. I didn't even know what all the words meant in that. Particularly that stanza that says, Here I raise mine Ebenezer, hither by thy help I'm come. What in the world was an Ebenezer to a 17-year-old boy the day he got saved? I didn't know that that was, in the Old Testament, a stake that people would drive down when they made some sort of a commitment to God, so that they could go back to that Ebenezer from time to time and renew that commitment, sort of like the altar that Jacob built at Bethel when he went back in Genesis 35 to Bethel. You know, as we go through life, there are three distinct stakes in life that are driven down, that are markers in life for us. The first one, of course, is when we're born. When we're born, there's a stake driven down. We begin life, and that marker for me was August 16th, 1947. I'm 53, so you don't have to take time adding it up. But that was a marker for my life. And there's going to be another marker out here someday, if the Lord tarries His return in my lifetime, that I'm going to die. And there's going to be a marker driven down in my life right there. And there's going to be a tombstone someday, somewhere, that's going to have my name on it, and the marker date of my birth and the marker date of my death. And then for those of us who know Christ, there's one other, the most important marker of all. And that's when we come to know Jesus Christ and the free pardoning of sin, when we're saved. And we drive that marker down. For me, it happened when I was 17 years of age over here, when old things passed away and new things came. When I passed from death unto life, when I went from darkness into light. For some of you, it may be when you're 20 or 30 or 40, but along the way between those other two markers is that marker of conversion that determines a new direction in life for each of us. And most testimonies that are given around these three markers of life, these three stakes that are driven down. Paul, if you remember, gave his testimony twice in the book of Acts, in chapter 26 before Agrippa. And basically, his testimony was around those three markers. He spoke, first of all, about what his life was like before he came to know Christ, from the time he was born. He was born a Hebrew of Hebrews. And what his life was like between that stake and the one where he came to know Christ. Then he told about the Damascus Road experience and how he came to know Christ. And then what his life was like after that. Most of our testimonies are built around those three markers of life. What our life was like before we came to Christ. What our life is like, how we came to Christ, what it's been like since we came to Christ. And then there's that marker of heaven. And out there, we have the hope and the assurance of eternal life with Jesus Christ. But I want to ask you a question this morning. What about back there, before this first marker? Back there, before you were born, do you know that you have a testimony this morning about what God did for you before you were born? Now, don't get off on some weird theological tangent. You didn't exist before you were born, except in the mind of God. And Jeremiah gives us a testimony in chapter 1 of what God did for him before he was born. And every one of us have this testimony who know Christ. In Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 4, we read, Then the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I sanctified you. I ordained you to be a prophet to the nations. Jeremiah gives his testimony of what God did for him Before he was born. That phrase in verse 5, before you were born, there's a sense in which it modifies four verbs here in this text. I knew you, I sanctified you, I ordained you, and I formed you. And those four verbs make up the four points of a testimony that each of us have of what this great Creator God did for us before we were born. Here's the first part of your testimony. You can write it down. He knew me. What an awesome thought. He knew me. Before I formed you in the womb, he says, I knew you, God says. What a testimony you have. He knew me. That's an awesome thought. Before my parents knew me, God knew me and called me by my name. Before I was born, God knew me. Before I was formed in the womb, before those tiny cells of came together, the seed of my father, the egg of my mother, in conception, even before that, he knew me. And the word here in the language means more than some sort of an intellectual knowledge, but an intimate, close, personal relationship. And the tense tells us it's past action, completed action. It's already happened. Before I was ever born, he knew me. God says, I didn't have to wait until I formed you in the womb to know you. You've been in my mind all along. Before I formed you, I knew you. Does anyone really know you? You know, as a pastor, I would counsel with people. I've heard people say, you know, I've been married to him or I've been married to her for 20 years, and sometimes I think I really don't even know them. Does anybody really know you? Your anxious thoughts? No one knows you like God knows you. What a testimony you have of what God did for you before you were even born. He knew me. He knew me. There is design behind my life. There is purpose behind my life. There is reason behind my life. Before you were born, God knew you. He knew you, all this before you were born. It's what brought you to this place. Here's the second part of your testimony. First, he knew me. Secondly, he set me apart. Before you were born, I sanctified you, verse 5 says. Not only is your testimony that he knew me, but secondly, he set me apart. He put me off to the side from everybody else for his own personal pleasure. The word means to separate, to set apart. We get the word sacred. We get the word holy from this word in verse 5. He sanctified me. He took me before I was born from everybody else, and he set me apart for a purpose. There is design behind your life. There's purpose behind your life. The same word we come and find sacred, holy there. And again, it's completed action. Before you were ever formed in the womb, not only did he know you, but he set you apart. He sanctified you. He looks upon you as sacred. He looks upon you as holy. Holy. You know, one of the ways you might define holy is simply to say different. God is not like you are. He's holy. In the sense that his ways are not our ways and his thoughts are not our thoughts. When Isaiah got a vision of him in the temple, and that those angelic choirs and antiphonal chorus began to sing, holy, holy, holy. And Isaiah said he was high and he was separate. He was lifted up. He was holy. He was different from everybody else. God is saying that you're different. That he set you apart, that there is design and purpose behind your life, that somewhere there's something for you to do that he has fashioned and formed you to do that no one can do quite like you can. You know, there are not a lot of things that are called holy in the Bible. There was a room in the temple that was called holy. In fact, it was called the Holy of Holies. It was different. It was different from the other rooms. Women couldn't go into that room. Priests couldn't go into that room. It was different. That was where the Shekinah glory of God, that's when the high priest on the Day of Atonement would sprinkle the blood over the mercy seat. That room was different from all, you didn't play volleyball in that room. It was holy. It was different. It was called the Holy of Holies. The vessels that were used in temple worship were called holy. What does that mean? They were different from other kind of vessels. You didn't drink coffee out of them or tea out of them. They were set apart, sanctified for a purpose and a special use by God. In the Jewish dispensation, the Sabbath was called holy. It simply means it was different than the other 6 days of the week. It was set apart from the other 6 days of the week, and on that day, you didn't do certain things you did on those other days. Because it was holy. It was different. It was set apart. The tithe, Leviticus in that dispensation, the tithe was called holy. It simply meant that one-tenth of that income was different than the other nine-tenths. It was set apart. It was different for a particular, specific use. This is what Jeremiah is saying here. Before you were born, God said, I set you apart. I sanctified you. You're different from everybody else for my own special use. The same word he uses to describe the Holy of Holies, or the vessels, or the Sabbath, or the tithe, to indicate they were different from everything else. He uses the same word to describe you. He knew me. He set me apart, thus to use your life for any other purpose than to glorify God is a sacrilege. Because there's so much behind your being in this place of preparation than some decision you made of a life vocation. There is design behind your life. There is purpose behind your life. He knew you. He set you apart. You are indescribably valuable to Him. The tragedy is so many people in our churches go through life with no concept, no realization of this truth, that there is design behind life. There is plan, there is purpose, divine purpose behind life. So you have a testimony of what God did for you before you were born. He knew me. He set me apart. Do you see it? What a testimony you have. Here's the third part of your testimony. He gave me a job. He gave me a job. There's something for me to do that no one else can do like I can do because God has set me apart, formed me and fashioned me for this. Look what Jeremiah said. God said, I ordained you. For Jeremiah, in Jeremiah's case, it was to be a prophet to the nations. He gave me a job. The word means appoint, assign, designate. The same word is used in Genesis 1:27 in the creation account where the Bible says that God set, S-E-T, set the stars in their courses. Every single one of them. He placed there. He designated. He set them there. Each has a place. And since that time, they've been running in clock-like precision. He set them there. Just as He set the stars in the space, He uses the same word to frame this thought that He has ordained you. There is something you can do. He has designated you. He has given you a job that nobody can do quite like you can do. And again, the tense tells us that this is all completed before you were ever born. There's design behind your life. There's a plan behind your life. There is purpose behind your life. Thus, success in life is the ability to find the will of God for your life and to do it. Not just to find the will of God for your life. Because a lot of people do that. But true success in life is to find the will of God for your life and do it. That's why it has nothing to do with materialism. It has nothing to do with what you drive or what church you pastor or what town you live in or what clothes you wear. It has to do with that purpose of God in your life, the job that God has assigned you, that place that nobody can do, no one can serve like you can because it's His design and His purpose before you were born. And that's why when you're about to graduate and panic sets in, where am I going to serve? What am I going to do? Where am I going to go? There's purpose behind your life. Somewhere there's a job for you that He has when you rest in the comfort of His will that no one can do quite like you can do. When our daughters, we have two, my wife Susie and I have two daughters, Wendy and Holly. And when Holly was at the university, she had lived in the dorm for the freshman year, and then she and some of her roommates moved out into an apartment. And so Susie and I were over there in Fort Worth. She went to TCU, and we went over from Dallas one day to fix up some of her this apartment that the girls had gotten. And so Susie and Holly were back in the bedroom, working on the bedroom, and Susie had bought a little pedestal table about that big in circumference, and just it was very simple to put together. It just had one pedestal you put on the bottom of it and four screws that went around it, just a little table for near a chair. And so she said, "See that there's a table in that box. Put it together while we're back here in the bedroom." So I'm not the greatest handyman in the world, but I opened the box up, got the instructions out, took the screws out, put the table down on the bottom, put the pedestal on top of it. They had four screws. How difficult can this be? And the holes were already driven where the screws would go in easier. And I put those four screws in there. Those Phillips, they were Phillips screws. Those little screws that had the little X in it. But I didn't have a Phillips screwdriver. So I went in the kitchen. I pulled a kitchen knife out of the kitchen deal. I went back in there. And so I started trying to screw those things down. My knuckles started getting bloody where it'd slip off. The end of the knife just got bent completely over. And I barely had one of them in when my wife came back in about 30 minutes later and asked me why I hadn't got it done yet. And she saw what I was doing. And she went over to her little toolbox that she had. And she said, "Here, dummy, take this," and tossed me this Phillips screwdriver. And as soon as I put it in that nut, in that screw, it felt so good. And I began to tighten it. And it felt so good. It was working. It'd go down and it'd screw down and it'd go down and it'd screw down. And it felt so, and I'd tighten it real tight. It felt so good. And you know what else? I felt so good about myself. You know what the difference was? That screwdriver was doing what it was designed to do. That knife wasn't. That knife was never designed to screw a Phillips screwdriver. But when we're doing what we were designed to do, we feel so, it feels so right. And we feel so good about ourselves in the process. Here some of us are perhaps trying to fit life, but it just doesn't seem to fit. Not right. Not in the will. Why? Because perhaps we're going through life. God's purpose and design and plan is for one thing, and we're trying to make it fit something else. So here we are with a testimony of what God did for us before we were born. He knew me. He set me apart. He gave me a job. And here's the fourth part of your testimony. He formed me. He formed me. I formed you in the womb. Look at your testimony. He knew me. He set me apart. He ordained me. All in completed action before I was born. And then here comes this word that indicates that He's still in the process of doing this. He's still in the process of forming me and fashioning me and molding me and making me what He wants me to be. Listen to verse 5. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I sanctified you. I ordained you to be a prophet of the nations. And let me just parenthetically say, this brings a whole new issue to the abortion debate. Most of what we talk about in abortion is what takes place in the present. It takes an innocent life. Or what takes place in the future in post-abortion syndrome and emotional distress that so many ladies go through. But what about the past? What about the past? Abortion doesn't just take a life, but it messes with God's eternal plan for an individual. It's not just the sanctity of life that's at stake. It's the sanctity of God's plan and purpose for a life that's at stake. So here we are. He knew me. He set me apart. He gave me a job. And then what? He formed me. He formed me. The word means to squeeze into shape, to form, to fashion, to frame. It's used dozens of times, as most of you know, in the Old Testament. Perhaps the most familiar one is right here in Jeremiah in chapter 18, when Jeremiah went down to the potter's house. and saw the potter at work on a wheel with just a lump of clay, and then he began to form it, and he began to fashion it, and he began to mold it, and he began to make it. Maybe there was a little lump of grit in it that had to be removed, maybe a little bubble of vanity, but all the while he was forming and fashioning, and through life, that's what happens to us. The potter's hand, sometimes pressing a little harder here, because there's a part of us that needs to be formed, a part of us that needs to be fashioned, squeezing us into shape so that we fit perfectly that for which he designed us to fit. You know, there's a page on the internet where you can every day, 24 hours a day, every 30 seconds, get a picture of the Kotel, the Western Wall. And in fact, you can get to it from the webpage of the Jerusalem Post. And you can click on there, and there's a live picture of the Western Wall, 24 hours a day. And of course, there you see those big stones, really, from Herod's temple. But there's an amazing thing that is said in related to the building of the temple over in 1 Kings, where it said that the temple, when it was built, the stone was finished at the quarry so that, quote, no hammer or no chisel was heard on the Temple Mount. What a miracle building. How amazing that all those great, massive, multi-ton stones in that ancient world were cut at the quarry and brought to the temple and put in place so that everyone meshed and everyone matched perfectly, and not the sound of a hammer nor a chisel was heard on the Temple Mount trying to fit those stones into place, because they all fit perfectly. It is an amazing trait, an amazing, miraculous event. God formed you for a special place where you fit perfectly. You don't have to force it. Before you were born, He knew you and set you apart and ordained you and gave you a job. He had this in mind, and He's through your life been forming you and squeezing you and fashioning you to bring you to this place, to prepare you for that place. And you don't have to take a hammer. You don't have to take a chisel. You don't have to try to make it fit. Today, He desires to fit you into the place He has for you before you were born. The stone is living a life without frustration of trying to make something fit. For He's not only known you all this time, not only set you apart different from everyone else all this time, not only given you a job that nobody else can do, but He's also about the business of continuing to form you and fashion you for His special purpose, so that no one else fits that purpose and that place and that plan quite like you. You are so valuable to Him. The New Testament equivalent of this word, I suppose, is found over in Ephesians 2. We often quote 8 and 9. But what about verse 10? For we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus unto good works, which God hath before ordained that we should walk therein. We are His workmanship. His what? His poema. His poema. His poem. His work of art. His special creation is what you are. God has a purpose and a plan for you in which He's forming you and fashioning you. Comfort zone. The greatest motivation to get out of them and stay out of them is to realize that there is design and purpose. That behind it all, there is someone who loves you like no one ever loved you, who knows you like no one has ever known you, who looks upon you as so sacred and valuable to Him that He sets you apart from everybody else, who's ordained you to a special task, and who loves you and cares for you enough to not let you go, but who continues to form you and to fashion you, to mold you, and to make you. Don't go through life trying to make something fit, using a screwdriver to try to screw in a Phillips screw. It feels so right, and you feel so good about what you're doing when you find the will of God for your life and do it. For that is true success in life. You have a testimony of what God did for you before you were born. He knew me. He set me apart. He sanctified me. He gave me a job. All for His glory. You're not here by accident. You are so indescribably valuable to God. And somewhere, there's a job for you to do that nobody can do quite like you can do. Make this your testimony. Surrender your heart and life to the will of this one who's the lover of your soul. For his glory, for your good, for the advancement of his kingdom. May the blessing of God be upon you.